Can eat a pen. Be careful, friends. I'm throwing this straw in the wind out there for any of you kid types who may think that you're in a saddle, man. There's a straw in the wind that the worm is turning. May I read to you a little news note we just got in from the AFP a wire, huh? Milano, Italy. Students are holding Milan's Vittorio Veneto High School, except for one section, which their parents have taken away from them. The students had occupied the school for 10 days, camping in the classrooms and studying quotations from Mao Zedong's Little Red, the book. Then their parents decided it was time to put the children back to work. They stormed the school last Tuesday. Parents by the masses, by the thousands. The students tried to hold off the assault with the water barrages. They even tried the brutality and the fire hydrant squirtings, but they were hopelessly outnumbered and driven into the streets by the raging parents. Then the parents, having won the battle, abandoned all but a smaller section of the school. The students returned to continue their sit-in and plot the strategy. The parents have agreed to hold on to their, quote, the liberated area on the advice of the school, the principal. Little 48,000 angry parents. That's... Oh, man, storming the library, you know, throwing the kids. La, happy birthday to you. Oh, hey, here's an ad, friends. Washington, D.C. It says, a little ad, want ads? I collect want ads, they're great. Washington, D.C., professional landlord wanted. I didn't know there was a profession called landlord. I thought you owned something, and you were a landlord, you know. But apparently you could be one. Professional landlord wanted. Here's a great opportunity for an experienced professional landlord to make a really fantastic deal. We are looking for a qualified landlord. Can't you see Simon Legree? Reading this ad. And I guess you'd call Simon Legree a qualified, professional, experienced landlord, right? Oh, yeah, we one time did Uncle Tom's Cabin. This is a great little play there one time. We did it in seventh grade. And I remember Esther Jane hopping from one piece of cardboard ice to the other. And with those great big old dogs played by Schwartz and Flick yapping at her. They were wearing dog suits. Oh, high point in drama. Won't you come home, Bill Bailey? Won't you come home? Had a letter from a kid here. He says, Dear Chef, having reached the obsolescent age of 15 and fearing, I'm quoting exactly here, having reached the obsolescent age of 15 and fearing the need of transportation, wheels in the future, I purchased with the reluctant help of the old man, A, dot, 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 dot. Listen what this kid bought. 1936 Hudson Terraplane Coupe. Now, aside from its unbelievable craving for low-octane juice and the fact that its 88-horsepower rubber band motor is pulling as much steel armor as a complete Panzer division, the car is fair. Okay, Shepard, what foreboding evils can you warn me of? Yourself being a Hudson Terraplane slave once, but I beg to differ. I did not own a Hudson Terraplane. I owned a Hudson Hornet. Much more esoteric car. Also, why does this car, Shepard, hate mankind? Well, kid, all I got to say, kid, is that you hang on. Hello there, Pat. I'm just answering the letter here from a listener who asked me, why does the Hudson Terraplane hate mankind? Did you ever own a Hudson Terraplane, Pat? You didn't. Well, I once owned a Hudson Hornet. And for those of you out there who wonder about machines that, strike back, but really do hate mankind, I would like to report that I learned a great deal of the facts of life from trying to make my Hudson Hornet go. Because this Hudson Hornet, believe me, was not just a piece of junk. It was an aggressive piece of junk. I mean, you know, it worked at night. I can remember in the house, you know, when everything was quiet and you could hear the birds going to sleep out there and you could hear the crickets chirping. Out in the backyard, you could hear my Hudson Hornet drinking gas. It drank gas when it was turned off. You could just slopping it up out there, you know, and once in a while you'd hear the oil dripping. It had some kind of special gaskets to let the oil drip out. No matter where you parked, the oil would drip out. Oh, yeah. I remember one time, you know, one of the most embarrassing moments I ever had in my life. I'm on this date, see. I just gotten out of the Army, and I walk around, and I want to buy a new car, a used car. See, I walk around, I go over the place, and I see these Plymouths and these Chevys. You know, it's ordinary cars, see. When I came upon this magnificent beauty sitting there in the parking lot, it was, you know how the Hudson Hornet looked like? It looked like a Chris-Craft on wheels. You have a great big gold one. You remember those fantastic things? So I see this Hudson Hornet, and I walk up to Friendly Fred. He was the used car dealer, the Hungry Armenian, he called himself. And man, he was. I walked up to old Friendly, and he had these stainless steel teeth, see? He saw me coming. Oh, he could tell a patsy. One thing about a good used car dealer, he can tell a patsy as far away as maybe, oh, just coming over the horizon. He can tell by the way you tie your tie. You know, there's a lot of little, you know, little subtleties. He could tell by the way I tied my tie that I was ready, see. And that, like all used car buyers, I had the myth going that I knew about cars. So I would walk around the car, and I'm looking at the tires, open up the hood. I want to take a look at the engine room, you know, look at the main office. He said, of course. He knew he had a real patsy here. Because the worst victims of used car dealers, I mean the real Sharpie types, are guys that think they know. He said, of course. Here, watch me. Out of the way here. So he reaches under. I should have known right then. Because the hood unlatched with a piece of string that came down from the bottom. And he reached underneath and pulled it. Boom, it goes. Up goes the hood like a great big clam. And I look down there, and you see this great big, it looked like looking into a West Virginia coal mine. You see this great big cavern with big black lumpy things all over in there, see? So I walk around this thing looking knowing. See, I had studied under my old man, who was an expert buyer of bad cars. He bought more bad. My old man did not ever buy a car in his entire life that had a good set of kingpins. Right from the minute we got every car we ever got, always bought used cars. From the minute we would drive out, it would start shimmying. You know, blah, 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 the front end. And, you know, he'd judge your car. He would judge your car about how bad it shimmied. He just accepted the shimmy as part of the car. I can remember us one time driving along the streetcar tracks, parallel to the streetcar tracks, on 111th Street in Roseland in Chicago. And for any of you expert drivers, you know what a car with bad kingpins, Tony, will do when it gets on the streetcar tracks, right? Boy, we couldn't get off the tracks. The car wouldn't get off the tracks. We were stuck on the tracks. And every time we would try to turn the wheel, so we're going along, and here comes a streetcar coming right at us. Well, the old man is frantically waving out of the front of the car, and the streetcar guy pulls up, and he stopped. And the old man gets out, and he says, I can't get her off the tracks. The streetcar guy says, I'm sorry, I'm on my way to Blue Island with 278 guys carrying lunch buckets. Now, where are we? And they're getting mad. So we could not get his car. That car, by the way, happened to be, in case you're interested, in Essex. So long, Pat. Oh, man, you could tell this is not the Martha Dean show, can't you, Dad? Oh, boy. So he throws it in reverse. You want to hear what he did? The old man. He throws it in reverse. See, he starts to go real fast in reverse. It shimmied in reverse, too, you know. He throws it in reverse, and he got the thing going, and we hit a curb, and we bounced right out. You know, and the streetcar went by, and the old man says, you know, got to learn how to drive. And so this was my kind of training, kid. I don't want to answer this question. I'm not going to go into the Hudson Hornet aeroplane mistake. It's a special mistake. But suffice it to say, the 20 minutes after I stopped by Friendly Fred, the Hungry Armenian's lot, I drove out the proud possessor of a Hudson Hornet. Now, one good thing about the Hudson Hornet, it had fantastic gas mileage. I mean, fantastic if you owned a Shell station, as a matter of fact. It was incredible. I mean, against all advice. You know, everyone says, he eats gas. And I said, come on, gas, schmash. All I got to do is adjust the carburetor. And it'll work. Yeah, keep the plugs clean. Listen, with a 45-mile-an-hour tailwind going downhill, right, Tony? With your foot half off the accelerator, this thing got roughly the same gas mileage as a Fifth Avenue bus, roughly, which is about 1.25 gallons a mile. Well, one of the worst embarrassing moments I ever had with my Hudson Hornet was shortly after I got this car. I had a date, and I was all dressed up, and I cleaned the car all up. We got in the car, we drove out. Everything was cool. You had a great radio in it. You notice when you really buy bad used cars, they always have great things like great radios. That's what sells, you see. Had a great radio. Had a tremendous set of windshield wipers, you know, that kind of stuff. Let me tell you this. It had a crankshaft made out of the purest balsa wood. It had pistons that I think must have been fashioned out of silly putty. It had compression. Well, it had compression like a 3-year-old kid sucking up a straw. That's kind of compression. Now, but nevertheless, I loved every last gigantic armor-clad inch of that monster, my Hudson Hornet. And I drove into Chicago drinking. I stopped at every third or fourth gas station on the way. We finally got up to the place we were going. We're going to this nice restaurant. We're going to go to the show. So I drove into this spick-and-span, beautiful, brand-new, sparkling concrete garage. You know, the kind that has three stories? Oh, it was beautiful. And cars really look good under those lights in there. So I drive into this place, and I could see a funny look on the face of the attendant when he came near that baby. You know, he'd driven 5,000 Hudson Hornet. He knew. So I get out of the Hudson Hornet, and on the other side, this chick, Dorothy, gets out, and she's all dressed up. And he gets into this car, this attendant. He gives me the slip, and he slides in. Wow! Wow! He boomed that thing out, and out of the back of that Hudson Hornet, there was this fantastic cloud of crud. It came pouring out of the exhaust pipe. Pieces of soot, big chunks of carbon, a fantastic cloud of dark blue smoke, edged in green and purple with lightning. It was rain. Ooh, all the stuff poured out. Catching me and Dorothy full blast with this sludge. Well, she was wearing this kind of light yellow spring dress, and I was dressed with my new light blue sport coat. And now it was a kind of a pinstripe sport coat, you know, with the oil running down. And he goes tearing up this ramp. And as he tears up the ramp, you could see him laying down a smoke screen, you know, just like you see pictures of a destroyer laying down a smoke screen when it's protecting an aircraft carrier. Whew, what a bomb. What a bomb of ruining. Speaking of, this is WOR, friends. Oh, aged calabashes, meerschaums, hand-carved briars. We are only discussing just the very skim, just the very outermost limits
of what they have down at Nat Sherman.
Nat Sherman.
They're at between 38th and 39th Streets on Broadway, and it's this great store. Now, if you're just walking around town and you want to refresh your soul, you just walk into Nat Sherman's and take a good, clean, deep breath. Fantastic place. What a smell. It smells great. About 25,000 types of esoteric tobaccos. And if you'd like to have one of their groovy catalogs, you just call 524-1400 tomorrow. 524-1400 tomorrow and ask if Joel's okay. Just ask if he's okay and tell him you want the catalog. Nat Sherman, 1400 Broadway, between 38th and 39th, right in the heart of Fun City. Please, Tony, will you bring it in there? Come on, let's go. That's enough, Tony. Won't you come home, Bill Bailey? Have a listener here who asked me a question. Says, Mr. Shepard, have you ever noticed the resemblance between Mayor Lindsay and the late Zazu Pitts? Right down to the hand-wringing helplessness. We'll let that float out there in the atmosphere. Oh, for heaven's sakes. He also says there is no truth to the rumor that in India, a topless diner is called a nude deli. That is awful. And he goes on to say, but of course he's wrong here. He thinks he's being, you know, brilliant by saying he predicts that our playwright's next big discovery will be incest. Well, I'm going to go on record of telling you that if any of you guys who've listened to my peregrinations over the years, you will know that as long ago as 5 years ago, I predicted that there would be a great sweep of so-called homosexual drama. A long time ago. You remember me predicting that? And then I predicted at that time that the next move, of course, would be the next obvious Freudian move, and that would be the next big theme in playwrights. It's got to be. It's just, I predict it totally. Will be incest. Okay? I predicted that 4 or 5 years ago, and I must go back on quoting, my own. One more. Did you see that cartoon in Look? Speaking of that, one cartoon in Look, one long-haired squirt says to another, "My old man has seen The Graduate 9 times. But for the wrong reason. He just digs Mrs. Robinson." Why not? Won't you go home, Bill Bailey? Won't you go home? Hey, listen, I got something here I have to report before we go any further. And, we got a note here from Newark, Delaware, and it was in the paper there. He says, there's nothing, and we're quoting it here, there's nothing like a cockroach ticking after dinner. Now, before you get bugged, how about brain surgery on one of these creatures? Listen, you want to hear a wild story? At the annual luncheon Saturday of the University of Delaware's Research Foundation, scientists who were sitting around having lunch heard, without alarm, all about the cockroach's biological clock. Dr. Stephen D. Skopik, assistant professor of biology, told the 150 persons present about how he isolated this clock via brain surgery. He showed the group how surgery in various areas of a cockroach's brain made changes in the cockroach's activity patterns, and how certain external stimuli, such as light and darkness, influenced this little biological clock he's got in his bean. Skopik was one of 3 speakers. We discussed various aspects of the cockroach. Now, I kind of like that as a luncheon topic. I mean, you know, I could just see some guys sitting there dozing off. The professor saying, "Now, on behalf of the department, I would like to show you via this graph. Would you please flash the next slide son? We'd like to show you this graph that shows the various stimuli as applied to the time linear coefficient of the roach's ability to digest the food which we have given to him just 3.5 minutes before the stimuli was applied. Next slide, please." Click. And you see this cockroach. And I can see this guy sitting there, you know, just drifting away, blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, out from under his plate,
two little feelers come sneaking out. Two little roguish eyes. And that little sleek brown shell. Oh, yes. Well, now, we know that the cockroach is beginning to get slowly more and more appreciated. That the cockroach is very much like mankind in a lot of ways. He is highly adaptable. So don't immediately sit down and write me an angry letter saying, please don't talk about cockroaches. After all, the cockroach is a fellow creature, and I don't want to hear any biases out there among you, right? Prejudices. And I like cockroaches. I do. In fact, in some places where I've lived, they've been my only friends. you get such kind of like them. But one thing about a cockroach, though, is that he's adaptable. Now, this is true of mankind, right? Also, he's very hardy. Well, you freeze a cockroach in a block of ice, and you unfreeze him, and by George, what does he do? Runs around and wiggles his feelers. Well, you're listening to a guy who also had that happen to him once. I'm going to tell you now, here we're coming to the point of the whole story. I am a man, one of the very few people you will ever know or have ever heard of, who actually was, one time, frozen into a block of ice. Did I ever tell you that story, Tony? Well, now, I'm going to tell it to you, and I want you to listen very carefully, gang, so you can cross your legs there, and take it easy, settle back, and now is tonight's story time. You know, when we walk around, we're human beings, we do all kinds of silly things. I wonder just how much we're going to have to answer for, all of us, I mean, en total, as mankind. It's 20th century mankind, 20th century American mankind specifically, when we arrive before that great bar of justice. And we have to answer for the stuff we did, right? Just like I can just see all those Romans standing there in front of the big bar of justice trying to explain those afternoons at the Colosseum with the lions. You couldn't blame one Roman for it, could you? No, it was a thing to all the Romans. They, even the guys who didn't go, they were somehow responsible, right? We always talk about Roman orgies. We don't specifically talk about Archilides and Archimedes and Theometris, who were there. We talk about Roman orgies, right? The whole thing goes down the drain. Everybody's blamed. Now, a lot of Romans were not invited to those orgies. Do you know that? Can you imagine? I've always thought about just the ordinary walking around people in any given time of history who were never invited. All the great stuff of their time. And so it follows that at the time of the great Roman orgies, when Roman society was at its absolute most decadent best, when the guys were sitting around the old swimming pool there, the baths, they didn't call them swimming, but the baths, the Roman baths made out of alabaster and marble with all kinds of symbolic shapes of dolphins squirting water and all that stuff. Here they are, they're lounging around these baths. The Nubian handmaidens coming in with grapes, with great big flaming shish kebabs. Oh, wow, they're running around. Well, now, has it occurred to you, friends, that immediately after the orgy, took 3 days to spin it out, when everybody going home with a head throbbing, they feel rotten, they're waiting for the next orgy, somebody had to come in and clean up the joint. Just the ordinary walking around guy. He comes in with his mop. He comes in with his pail. He's got the water. There's a lot of grape pits all over the place. He starts sloshing it down. Well, he was not invited, was he? No, sirree, Bob. You can bet your little old bibby he wasn't. You can put that in your old bippy and smoke it. He was not invited. He was the guy that came and cleaned it up. He was standing out in front selling the tickets. Or he was putting up the posters. Or he was blowing up the seat cushions at the Colosseum for the guys that came in to cheer down the Romans or the Lions. Somebody was down there cleaning out the cages. Oh, yes. Oh, that's right. There was a big afternoon at the Colosseum, somebody had to come in and, kind of tidy up. Make sure that the next day when Nero came in, it was kind of nice and spick and span. And nice new crew of Christians were ready for the whole big show. Well, now, these are the ordinary people. Now, as given during our time, everybody's reading in Life magazine about these fantastic sexual things that are going on in colleges and at the pot parties and all that stuff. Oh, no. Many, 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 many are not invited. Only a few partake. at any given time of the various debaucheries of the time. True, Tony? I would say for every Roman that was at an orgy as a participant, there were 200,000 silent washer-uppers whose biggest orgy was to come home Saturday night after a hard day in the fields growing onions or grapes or whatever it is that they were going to eat at the at the orgy, whose biggest moment was to come home and say, oh, take off his sandals and say, oh, my feet are killing me. Oh, please, let me just sit here for a minute with my feet cool off and pour a little water over his feet and watch the steam rise. That was his high point of life. And then being allowed to quietly slip into a few hours of sleep because the next day he had a big job at the Colosseum sweeping up again. Well, that is the way it always is. And I just wonder how many countless millions of people out there feel cheated. They keep reading about this stuff in Life and Time, and they never get the invitation. They begin to suspect it's not going on. That's really what happens, you know. Oh, come on, that's newspaper talk, they say. Oh, yeah? Well, this is the way it always is. And so, there I was. Right? Now, I'm going to tell you, there are some people who do get invited, friends, who do the crazy, nutty things that you see in Life magazine. How they get there, why they get there, is a long story. And I'm going to tell you such a sad story tonight. See, I'm a kid. And I'm about 17. Now, that's a kid, I guess. They call him a kid now. I'm 17. And I got this summer job in this little cockamamie radio station, right? Now, this radio station was totally, completely out of its bird for the promotion scene. I mean, they had no programs. Their programs were rotten. They had no sponsors. In fact, they barely had a transmitter. We had this old transmitter they got out of one of these want ads in broadcasting. You know, the kind that says, excellent cabinet. Comes with no guts, but there's plenty of nice wood and plenty of nice rack and panel with it. And so there we were, struggling away, this little radio station. And one day, and I'm 17, see, there was only me and two other guys working on the station. So one day, the manager comes in and he says, Shepard, come in my office. Well, now, his office had been a John before. we had a terrible city. And they had taken out everything. You could still see the pipes coming out of the walls. So he had this little desk he got at the Salvation Army. And I come into the office and I said, yes. He says, Shepard, I've just worked a promotion deal. And we're going to do a big promotion. And you're going to be it. I said, I'm going to be it? What? What? That sounds great. Right away. I was ready for anything. See? He said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. The circus is coming to town. I said, it is? Thinking, of course, that I'm going to get a free ticket or something. We're going to have spots for the circus. He says, the circus is coming to town, and I just had a meeting with the promotion manager of the circus. Ring, ding, and ding, dong circus. I said, that sounds interesting, Chief. He said, yep, it is. And we've decided that what we're going to do to promote the circus and, of course, promote WKLUNCK, old clunky, what we're going to do to promote both our radio station and the circus, we're going to freeze you in a block of ice. I said, what? Yes, we're going to freeze you in a block of ice. I said, freeze me in a block of ice? That's great. Yep. Freeze you in a block of ice. Now, here's the way it's going to work. Monday night, when the circus begins to operate here in town, they're coming to the town over Saturday and Sunday. They're going to set up the tents. Monday night, they're having the first performance. And we are going to go on the air at 8 o'clock that night, and you are going to broadcast from a tank where you are about to be frozen into a block of ice. A remote. I said, oh, that's exciting. Yep. He says, and then, of course, as it starts to freeze, we're going to return to you, and you're going to tell us how it feels. And then you're going to stay there all night in that thing while it's freezing. I said, I'm staying there all night. He says, yes, we hope to have you frozen in a block of ice for one solid week. And you will broadcast every 3 hours a 5-minute broadcast from the grounds, live. And people will come to see you. Of course, it's going to be a fantastic gimmick. They're going to come to see you, and they're going to watch you broadcasting live from a cake of ice. Well, I was 17. And innocent. And
I wanted to make my way in radio. I was all excited about it. And so sure enough, bright and chipper with my new blue sport coat, I showed up at the circus grounds 1 half hour before the opening performance. All excited. My engineer was down there. We had a big sign that had our radio station's call letters on it, and it was called something like the Concern Station, the station that brings you the news, views, and the sound of our community. Bump, 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 1, 2, 3, on the dial, where coal meets iron. You know, all these big things, slogans. It says, watch Gene Shepherd, frozen in a solid cake of ice. He will broadcast live from the cake of ice every 2 hours, 5 minutes, for the entire week that the circus is in town. A daring feat never before attempted on radio. Well, you know, it was, I might say, that in all my experience in radio since, I have never heard of anybody who actually did broadcast for a solid week from a cake of ice. Well, I did. The first day, there's about five guys who, see, they knew all about this. You see, they knew how to freeze guys in blocks of ice. Apparently, they had frozen guys before. They had a big tank, and in the tank was set another tank. Now, the tank outside was all filled with this cooling solution. They had some kind of a ammonia solution, just like wired with pipes. It's like a big refrigerator. And in the inner tank was plain, ordinary white water. And they gave me a rubber suit. And through the side of the tank, there were little air holes, and they had all kinds of things come in so you could breathe. And they had a thing where you could be fed from. You got a little pipe come down. And they gave me this rubber suit, and attached to the rubber suit was a microphone. It was just attached right to the thing that they had built. It was like a talkback microphone that they had used the suit before. And so I thought it was great. They're groovy. So I climbed into the tank, and there were 1,000 people there, and they all cheered. I was wearing this rubber suit, and I waved. At 8 o'clock, the engineer gave me the cue, and I was on for the first time. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, this is Gene Shepherd, old chef, and I'm broadcasting right now from a tank right on the grounds of the big circus. Come on down and watch me. And for the next week, I will be frozen into this block of ice. And it's a daredevil feat never before attempted on radio. And I will give you my impressions, my ideas, the sights and sounds of this exciting circus. Yes, sirree. And not only that, we will give away free tickets to the circus for anyone who can tell on what day I will be completely frozen and on what day they'll have to take me to the hospital and resuscitate me, right? And so, friends, here we go. And I'm going to return you into the studio in just a few moments. Here I go, into the tank. Now, let's hear a crowd. Let's hear that big round of applause. And the crowd cheered. About 1,000 people standing around because they promoted this. And I got down in the tank. Water all around me. And they were pumping in air to me. It didn't even feel cool, really, because of this rubber suit. I lay down there. And I felt like great showbiz. I felt the center of everybody's eyes. Everybody was watching. I waved in the tank. Got my rubber suit on. And they waved back. And the chicks were looking in, and the guys were watching, and guys were eating ice cream cones. That was a historic moment. The only thing that happened, though, that really bugged me that first night was that the circus started. The performance started, and everybody went away. There I was, just a tank, all by myself. What a drag. Nothing. I sat around. I could see the water. You could see very clearly everything outside of the water. And it was getting pretty chilly by then. They had the machine started. You could feel it jiggling. You could feel the whole big refrigeration machine going. And all of a sudden, it was now 10 o'clock. I had to go on again, you see, every 2 hours. During our broadcast day, we signed off at noon, or midnight, rather. Came out again at 5:30 in the morning. So, here it is, 10 o'clock. And my engineer shows up again, and he's eating a big sandwich. He's been in watching the beautiful chicks running up and down the trapezes and all that. What have I been? I've been under a tank there in the water. And so he's looking outside. He says, give me a level. You can see him. Speak. He's making with the sound. So I said, hello, 1, 2, 3, 4, into my rubber microphone. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. He's sitting out there with his little Collins portable thing. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. He said, okay. And he waited. And then he threw it at me. And I said, hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gene Shepherd, and I'm still in that tank. And it's been a very exciting experience. And I can feel the water's getting cooler now. And, by George, I'll bet they're going to freeze me right here in this place. It's going to be exciting. Why don't you come down and watch? It's very exciting. And, boy, what a great circus. I want to tell you there are more tremendous acts here at this. I hadn't seen one act, nothing. I saw just water bubbling around me. I said, what an exciting circus, folks. And I'll be reporting here from deep inside his tank. By now, I'm beginning to have a slight suspicion. I have been had. A slight suspicion. Yes. A slight suspicion. Now, I didn't tell you that I had been promised, as a result of being frozen into a block of ice for one solid week, as a result of a promotion deal between the radio station and the circus, I had been promised a substantial bonus. Well, of course, at that time, I was earning a cool $23.50 a week if I did my special shows, which I was occasionally assigned to, which gave me special talent fees. Like I got 75 cents when I did the Toledo Tabernacle Hour. It's a 75 cent talent fee. Especially if I sang in the choir after announcing the opening. I'd run around the back and sing, see? And so I got a special deal on that one. So I was making pretty good, and I figured, you know, it's a big special bonus. Well, so the motivation was there. So I stayed in that tank after the broadcast. The engineer walked around. It's getting dark. I could see guys out of the tank, circus guys. They're pushing barrels around, and they're carrying bales of hay. And once in a while, one would look at me, absolutely, totally ignoring me, and the machine is running all the time. It's getting colder and colder and colder. Well, about midnight, after the circus grounds were almost totally empty, a guy came and knocked on the outside of the tank. And I looked. And he says, come on out. He waved. It was a fake. He waves me out. I thought I was going to be in there for a week. And so I stood up in the tank. And, oh, were my knees stiff. Oh, boy, have you ever stayed under water for 2.5 hours? Gee, was my everything felt funny. And so I couldn't stand very well. And everything felt heavy. It was wild because, you see, I had no weight under the water. I was kind of floating up and down. I staggered, grabbed the edge of the tank, and he helped me out. He said, take off the suit, kid. Come on, I ain't got all day. I'm not working on overtime now. Come on, let's get that thing off. So I take the suit off. Big, tough foreman. I give him the suit. He said, what time are you coming back tomorrow? I hadn't told me this. I said, what time am I coming back tomorrow? Well, what time do you open? He said, well, we're here about 8 o'clock in the morning. We start selling tickets. You better be here. So they see you in the tank. 8 in the morning. 7 o'clock the next morning, still stiff and cold. I reported for duty. Went down into the tank, and at 8 o'clock I could see the crowds of kids walking around carrying bags of peanuts. They brought the school kids in early to watch them set up the, you know, all that stuff in them, and I could see all the people, and they'd wave at me once in a while. I stayed in that tank that second day until midnight, from 8 a.m. till midnight. And around about noon, the ice began to form. And I couldn't move my arms. Do you know that I was actually frozen in a block of ice? Every day from noon until midnight, there was nothing but ice around me. And every 2 hours, the engineer would wave and knock on the top of the tank, and I would say, hello, gentlemen. I'm broadcasting from a tank of ice, and it's very exciting. It's very exciting. I'm here on a circus grounds, it's very exciting. I want all of you to come down and see this exciting circus. it's very exciting.
Well, this went on for an entire week. I think this forever affected my attitude towards life, showbiz, ice. You can't talk me into skiing anymore. That's kid stuff. Even at this time, once in a great while, when I'm in a philosophical mood, when somebody says, give me bourbon on the rocks, and I take a look at those ice cubes, somehow I have a sense of empathy. Somehow, Ice Cubes and me were out of the same atmosphere, the same milieu, the same, shall I say, the same background. Well, finally, at long last, they had the big unveiling, the whole point, the whole culmination of the entire promotion. You see, everybody thought I was in there all the time. The culmination of the whole week was to come at 9 o'clock, right in the middle of the final performance of the circus, when they unfroze me, and I emerged after a week of harrowing experience being frozen in the ice. And they wheeled me in. I'll never forget that. It was one of the wildest moments that I ever had in the entire, my whole life of theater and showbiz and performance, the whole shtick. I'm lying there, and the engineer has given me the cue. You see, we're going to go on in about 5 minutes. He says, watch it. See, it's in 5 minutes. And I'm lying in this block of ice. It's been freezing now since about 10 o'clock that morning. They started it early that day. They wanted to make sure it was real frozen. See? And they froze me in this block of ice from about 10 o'clock on. And here it is now. Oh, does the time go slow? You know, when you're in ice, friends, you don't have any chance to read. You really are frozen. You can't read. You can't do anything. You just lie there. And you examine your navel. And you know that they were starting to complain. They could talk to me back. I had earphones plugged in the thing here. They could talk to me, and it was saying, you know, your broadcasts are getting kind of funny. And he says, why don't you lighten it up a little? Towards Thursday, I was getting very philosophical, like saying things like, friends, have you ever wondered what it's all about? You don't say that in the middle of a broadcast of the circus. Things like, you know, I begin to believe now, friends, the time is the great enemy, the thief. Friends, and then they cut me off. So here it is, Friday night, the big high point, the culmination of the week of being frozen into that fantastic block of ice. And the band stuff. You give me a little of that fast. Oh, so flip it over, Tony, on the other side. You'll find a wild thing on cut one. What is it? What's that? Is that side one, cut one? That's what I want. All right. And oh, they had this big band scene. It was all rehearsed, all prepared. Although I had never been involved in the rehearsal. They just told me it was all rehearsed. All they said was, you just lay still, kid. You just lay still. And sure enough, at 5 minutes to nine, I felt my big block of ice moving. And they were towing it in with three gigantic elephants with these enormous golden hookahs or howdos or hookahs or hoodahs or whatever they are on top of it, with the guys that looked like Sabu the Elephant Boy. I could see them up there, and they're towing me in, and I could see dimly through the ice 1,000 cheering crowds, and I could hear the band playing. Oh, man. The band was playing all that. It was fantastic. I'm in showbiz. Oh, oh, man. And then the band stopped playing, and I could hear that voice echoing dimly.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. The man who has defied death for one solid week, frozen in a cake of ice, will be now released and will emerge, we hope, unscathed. And now, please give me your total undivided attention as we slowly chip away the ice from this brave young man's body.
And three guys dressed in black suits, three men dressed in black suits stood around and chipped, Jen chipped. Hello. Three guys stood around and chipped and chipped, and I could see the ice picks going as the ice is slowly beginning to fall away from me. And then, at long last, there was enough taken off so that I could stand up. And I stood up, weak. I'd been there since 10 o'clock in the morning. I stood up, my knees, and I could hear the crowd. A tremendous roar of applause. And they shoved the microphone, the PA system, in front of me. And I'm wearing my rubber suit. And the man, the ringmaster, who looked like Claude Kirshner, by the way, the ringmaster, stood before me with a microphone.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the first words as he emerged from the block of ice. How do you feel, young man? How do you feel after being frozen on a cake of ice for one solid week?
I couldn't think of anything to say. All I could say was, what's excited?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Let's give him a big hand. Hey, the young man, I am.
And it was all over, just like that. I'm backstage now with the Lions and Tigers. And Monday morning, I got my tremendous, unforeseen bonus. What do you think it was? An autographed picture of the ringmaster. I never forgot that, friends. And so, like the cockroach man is infinitely tough and infinitely adaptable, you can freeze him in a block of ice, he will survive. Yes, he will survive. You can blow the hot winds of adversity over him, he will survive. You can give him autographed pictures of ringmasters, he will survive.